$12,000 a month? Lupe asked.
Holy, that's serious money, Hank exclaimed.
$144,000 a year, serious, to be exact.
Hank slapped his leg. That's it, I'm in, he declared.
Hank emptied every pocket of every jacket. He dug his fingers into the backs of his chairs and checked under his bed for money. He even checked in his shoes. He managed to find $78.56, which wasn't a lot, but it was something. The other weeklies, as soon as they heard, wanted to contribute too. Fred put in $100, and Billy Bob put in $200. Mrs. T contributed $250, but it was Mrs. Q who put in the most, a whopping $3,000. Hank whistled.
You got $3,000 lying around and you're living in this dump? He asked her. Why don't you get an apartment?
This isn't a dump, Mrs. Q said. This is home. And besides, if I lived in an apartment, I'd never meet all of you wonderful people.
She gave my shoulder a squeeze. Lupe skipped on home to talk to her parents. She said they had some sort of emergency fund, but she wasn't sure how much was in there. As for me, I dug out my essay from the contest. I made copies of the essay and passed it out to every single customer who came in. My plan was simple. Find 600 people to contribute $500 each. That would bring us to the grand total of $300,000. So far, we got $3,628 from the weeklies. We still had $296,371 to go. A few customers threw my story in the trash, but a surprising number didn't. They responded with genuine interest and curiosity. A few were moved by what I told them about our situation and the kind of year we had been having and how we got through it by pulling together as a family. They opened up their checkbooks and wrote checks for $700, $1,000, $4,000, $5,000, and even $8,000. One customer wanted to know my vision for the Cala Vista. His name was Mr. Cooper, and he was a venture capitalist from Los Angeles, passing through on his way down to San Diego. A venture capitalist, Mr. Cooper said, was someone who invested in small companies before they become big companies. Though he could afford to stay anywhere, Mr. Cooper still liked living frugally, and that's why he was at the Cala Vista.
Where do you see the Cala Vista in 5 years? Mr. Cooper asked me.
Right here, I said, a little confused by his question. He laughed.
No, I mean, what kinds of things do you expect from the Cala Vista?
I thought about it and said, I just want everyone to be happy, every single customer. Mr. Cooper smiled.
That's the kind of vision I like to hear. I'd be honored to invest, he said.
Mr. Cooper took out his checkbook and wrote us a check for a jaw-dropping $50,000. As he handed us the enormous check, my mother's hands shook. She'd never seen so many zeros all in one place.
I'm expecting big things from this place, Mr. Cooper beamed. Big things.
With Mr. Cooper's check and the other customers' contributions, we still needed about $230,000. So the next day, I went around to all the shops on the street. To my wild surprise, both Mr. Abayan from the convenience store and Mr. Bagawati from the dry cleaners wanted to invest.
Are you sure? I asked them.
Are you kidding? This is our chance to own a piece of land in America, they said.
They were tired of sending all their money back to their relatives month after month. For once, they were going to spend on themselves. They gave me $1,000 each, cash. I ran all the way home clutching the thick stack of hundreds in my hands. Lupe came over with even more thrilling news. Her parents talked it over, and they wanted to invest $10,000, the entirety of their emergency fund.
But it's your emergency fund, I said. Are you sure about this?
Lupe nodded. We've never been more sure of anything in our life, she said. As her dad added his chunk to the huge pile of money, Lupe and I grabbed each other's arms and jumped up and down, screaming,
We're getting off the roller coaster! We're getting off the roller coaster!
By the end of the week, we were $85,000 down, $215,000 to go. I took out the big ledger and started writing to old customers. I wrote to Mr. Lewis, the guy who gave me a hard time about the key and wanted all those extra pillows. To my surprise, he wrote me back and sent me a check for $100 along with a gift certificate to Home Depot for a better key machine. Mr. and Mrs. Miller, the nice couple who gave me an $8 tip, sent $75. They told their friend about it, a guy who made a fortune selling mops on the Home Shopping Channel on TV, and he called us up and wanted to invest. My dad then got on the phone and started calling up some of the immigrants who had stayed at our motel. When the immigrants heard, they wanted to get in on the deal too. Aunt Ling, Uncle Li, Uncle Feng, and Uncle Zhu each invested $100, $125, $150, and $200. Even Uncle Zhang, who had just gotten a new job parking cars at a parking garage, put in $88, which pleased my parents very much because of the number 8. Word got out that there was a killer investment opportunity, and soon immigrants all up and down the state were coming over to invest. "If we can't have the American dream ourselves, maybe we can have it together," the immigrants exclaimed. My parents were in awe. They could not get over the fact that so many people, total strangers, could believe in them like that, could look at them and decide, "Hey, I don't know you, but I believe in you. I believe in your dream," and put crisp green bills into their tired, blistered hands. One stranger after another, flesh and bones that looked into their eyes and said yes, when time and time again they looked at themselves and said no. 2 weeks later, an even more amazing thing happened. Hank walked into the front office with a stack of bills. He slid the cash across the front desk, a thick stack of 20s. "You found more money?" I asked.
"No, you found more money," he said.
I furrowed my eyebrows at him. I didn't understand.
"I got your money back from the essay people," he announced.
"You what?" I couldn't believe my ears. "How?"
"I took a page from your book," he said. "I wrote them a letter."
I reached over and touched the fresh green bills. My lucky penny money. I never thought I'd see it again.
"When I explained to them how young you are and how hard you worked for that money, they returned it like that."
Hank snapped his fingers. "Oh, Hank, thank you," I said. He waved away my thanks like it was nothing, even though what he did meant the world to me.
"So, what are you going to do with it?" Hank asked.
"I'll tell you what I'm going to do with it," I said. "I'm buying a motel with it."
"That's my girl," Hank beamed.
I wrote the Vermont people to say thank you for returning the money. That's when I had an idea. "Dear Vermont Motel Essay Organizers, thank you so much for returning my entry fee. Can you do me a huge favor? Can you please kindly help me send the following letter out to all the other people who entered the essay contest but did not win? It would mean a lot to me. Thank you. Mia Tang. Letter attached." "Dear Sir, Madam, my name is Mia Tang. I am 10 years old, and like you, I also entered the Vermont Motel Giveaway Essay Contest. For the past year, I have been helping my parents manage a motel in Anaheim, California. We have made it our home, from the towels we carefully fold each and every day to the customers we call family. But you see, the motel is not ours. It belongs to a man named Mr. Yao, who is unkind and unjust and stubborn as a rock. My parents think that working for Mr. Yao is the only way, but I don't think so. At night, I dreamed of a better way. I dreamed of owning a motel one day that was ours. So I entered the Vermont Motel Giveaway Essay Contest. Sadly, though, I did not win. I always knew losing was a possibility. What are the chances of actually winning a motel? But still, it hurt, watching my hopes and dreams disappear. You probably know the feeling. Well, maybe all our hopes and dreams don't have to disappear. I am writing to you because something has happened here at the Cala Vista Motel. Mr. Yao is selling the motel. He's selling it for cheap because he's desperate. We're all chipping in to see if we can buy it from him, and we're looking for investors. If you would like to invest, please let me know. It wouldn't be a donation. You would be one of the owners, and in the future, whenever a customer comes to stay at the Cala Vista, part of that money would go to you. You might be asking yourself, why should I invest in a motel from a 10-year-old? For three reasons. One, I know what I'm doing. I know every corner of this motel like the back of my hand because I've lived here and worked here for almost a year. Two, I love what I'm doing. I'm very proud of my work. Every day, I check people in at the front desk. The customers like me see enclosed feedback cards because I always go the extra mile for them. Three, I won't let you down. I will work hard every day for my dream and yours. So what do you say? If we can't win a motel, together, let's buy one. No investment is too small. Even if all you have are some extra pennies and nickels lying around, we'll take them. You'd be amazed what some of them are worth. I look forward to hearing from you. Yours truly, Mia Tang, manager. A few weeks later, the checks started rolling in. The Vermont essay people sent my letter out. And to my absolute amazement, people from all over the country sent in checks for $50, $100, $2,000, and even $10,000. By the end of that incredible month, and with everyone else's investments, we had reached $300,000. We cashed the checks at the bank and kept all the cash in a giant trash bag, which my parents held in their arms at all times and slept with at night in case any robbers came. Chapter 64. The nerves tingled in my toes as Mr. Yao's Lincoln Navigator pulled into the motel. We told him on the phone we had something very important to discuss with him.
"So, what's this all about?"
he asked, plopping himself down on the couch. Nervously, my mom looked at my dad. I glanced toward my room, where the trash bag of cash was, and out the small kitchen window where Hank's, Billy Bob's, and Mrs. Q's heads were squeezed together, trying to peer in. They all knew this was the big moment.
We'd like to discuss buying the motel, my mom said.
Mr. Yao sat up.
Why? Did an interested buyer come?
He asked. My dad cleared his voice.
Yes, he said. Well, who is it?
Mr. Yao asked.
Us, my dad said.
You?
Mr. Yao said. He started laughing.
How much did you come up with? $500?
He chuckled.
Actually, we came up with $300,000, my dad said.
Mr. Yao stopped laughing. A war was happening in Mr. Yao's face as denial morphed into rage.
How the heck did you get $300,000?
Mr. Yao finally asked.
That's not important, my dad said.
What's important is, do we have a deal or not?
Again, Mr. Yao burst out laughing.
Do we have a deal or not? Who do you think you are?
I jumped in. He's a guy who's about to buy your motel. That's who he is, I told him.
Oh, no, he's not, Mr. Yao snapped. There's another buyer interested, and he's offering more.
How much more? Mr. Yao shrugged.
How much? My dad repeated.
What's the difference? You can't afford it.
How much?
50,000.
We called up every single investor, but unfortunately, nobody had any extra money. They had already given us every dollar they had. Even Mr. Cooper said his hands were tied. He added that if the deal did not go through by the end of the month, he would need his $50,000 back, so he could put it into one of his other investments. I dropped my head into my hands. Everything was slipping away, all my hard work. It felt like losing the essay contest all over again, except it hurt so much more because this time I was letting everyone down. I hugged the humongous trash bag of money and cried. I cried for all the motel essay contest applicants who once again failed to get a motel. I cried for young Hank getting pushed around by all those mean kids and old Hank 40 years later still getting treated unfairly. And for Lupe's dad, boiling away on the roof every single day under the blistering sun. I cried for Mr. Abayan, the convenience store guy from the Philippines, and Mr. Bagawati, the laundry guy, with his raisiny fingers and hunched back washing bundle after bundle of clothes. I cried for Uncle Zheng, poor Uncle Zheng, who had no money but still insisted on contributing because it was so important to him to help us in our hour of need. And all the other uncles and aunts who sent us money, hoping for a slice, however tiny, of the American dream. And now it was all going to fall apart over $50,000. $50,000 we couldn't come up with it, even if you opened us up and sold us for parts. Slowly I stood. I dried my tears, picked up the bag of money, and walked into the living room.
"Hey, where are you going with that?"
my parents asked me.
I'm going to call the investors. Start returning all of this money, I told my parents. They shook their heads.
We have an idea, they said.
Chapter 65.
No, I said, shaking my head firmly. Just this once, my dad said. We're so close.
Dad, you saw what happened to Uncle Ming?
The memory of his black eye and the bruises on his neck where the loan sharks grabbed him ripped through me. I know, but this is different. You said it yourself. This is a huge opportunity.
I looked up at my dad. I had never seen so much determination and hope in his eyes.
We're this close, my dad said, holding up his fingers.
My mother put her hand over mine.
Just this once, she repeated. We'll pay them right back, just this once.
Hour after terrifying hour, I sat and waited at the front desk. The loan sharks were coming. I pictured hammerheads swimming up to the front desk, glaring at us from the sides of their heads. They pulled into the motel in a black Cadillac DeVille. Three big Chinese guys stepped out. They were all wearing leather jackets. One of them had a tattoo of the word Ren in Chinese on his neck, which means to suffer. Another had a big tear in his ear, like someone had ripped out his earring. And the third, the boss of the group, had oily skin and long, stringy hair, which he wore in a ponytail. There was a great big bulge in his jacket, and I swallowed hard as they stepped through the bulletproof glass door.
You understand, for an amount this large, we're going to need some collateral, the oily boss of the loan sharks said to my dad.
The three of them sat on the small sofa in our living room. With a trembling hand, my mom poured them the last of our jasmine tea.
Yes, my dad said. That makes sense. What do you need?
Passport, ID, he said.
I felt myself go cold.
But Uncle Zhang,
I reminded my dad. My dad put a finger over his mouth.
Not now.
It'll be returned to you, of course, when you pay us back, the oily boss said.
His voice lingered.
But if you don't pay us back the $50,000 plus another $20,000 on top, well then.
The boss glanced at his associates. His associates stretched out their hands and cracked their knuckles. With every crack, fear jolted down my spine. Chapter 66. It was decided that the next afternoon, the loan sharks would come back with the $50,000 and my parents would hand over our passports and IDs. I walked to school with nails in my stomach. It was the last day of school. As we all cleaned out our desks and counted down to the last hour, Jason walked up to me.
Hey, he said.
In his hand, he was holding a pencil. It was my sparkly green pencil.
Been meaning to give this back to you, he said, handing the pencil to me.
I looked down at the pencil in my hands. I'd expected it to be super short and beat up by now. I had had visions of Jason's dog chewing on it, Jason stabbing things at home with it, wearing it down to a nub. But it was exactly the same length as before and as beautiful and sparkly as ever.
Thank you, I said. This means a lot to me.
I hugged my pencil in my hands.
I'm sure you'll write great things with it, he added.
I looked up at him, surprised.
Like the piece you wrote about coming to America.
A smile stretched across my face.
Thanks, I said.
Jason looked down at the floor.
I'm sorry I made your year so miserable, he said softly.
It's okay, I said. I'm sorry, too, for, you know. I could see in his eyes I did not need to remind him about the time in the auditorium. He probably remembered every day. Here, I have something for you, too, I said. I reached deep into my backpack and pulled out the thank you letter I'd been meaning to give him. I'd been carrying it around in my backpack for months. Jason looked down at the note, surprised. He smiled as he read my words. As I turned to leave, Jason reached out and touched my arm.
What?
I asked.
He's bluffing. There's no other buyer. It's just you guys. He'll take a lot less for the motel.
I stared at Jason. His brown eyes blazed with courage. but it was his kindness that blew me away. When the school bell rang, I ran. Chapter 67. I ran as fast as the wind could carry me, adrenaline powering my skinny little legs. With each step, I whispered a prayer. Please, let me get there before the loan sharks do. I turned the corner onto Coast Boulevard just as the loan shark's Cadillac pulled into the motel. As the three loan sharks got out of their car with their suitcases full of cash, I raced into the parking lot screaming, Mom! Dad! Don't do it! Mr. Yao's bluffing! My parents promptly called the deal off. The loan sharks grumbled about how they came all this way and went to a great deal of effort to put the money together, so my dad gave them $20 for the gas and their troubles, and they piled back into their car and left. As they drove away, my parents collapsed onto the ground. That was close, my mother exclaimed. My dad put his hand over his pounding heart as he stared at the wide open sky. Thank God, my dad said. As my parents lay panting on the side of the parking lot, I walked over to the front desk and called Mr. Yao. Mr. Yao, we'd like to make an offer on the motel, I said. $300,000 and not a penny more.
He said yes!
I screamed, running through the motel. The Weekleys were in Hank's room playing Monopoly. When they heard the news that Mr. Yao agreed to sell to us, Hank slapped the Monopoly board and all the pieces went flying.
What did I tell you? Hank said to Billy Bob. If it can happen in Monopoly, it can happen in life.
Mr. Yao came over with Jason and his real estate agent the next day, as did Lupe, Lupe's dad, Mr. Cooper, the immigrants, Mr. Abayan from the convenience store, Mr. Bhagawati from the laundromat, and some of the motel essay people who had driven down because they wanted to see their new motel with their very own eyes. Mr. Cooper brought over his lawyer friend who helped us draw up the contract. There were so many people, we couldn't all fit in the manager's quarters. We had to put chairs and tables out in the parking lot.
All right, let's get this over with, Mr. Yao said.
It took ages for Mr. Yao and his agent to count up all the money. When he was finally convinced it was all there, Mr. Yao lugged the bag over to his car and dumped it in the trunk. His agent then sat down with Mr. Cooper's lawyer and pored over the sales and purchase agreement. We all huddled around them, watching as they wrote in each of our names under buyer. There were so many owners. We needed three additional pages just to fill out all our names. My father's voice shook as he told the agent how to spell his name.
I never thought this day would actually happen, he said.
Me neither, my friend, said Hank, putting an arm around my dad's shoulder. Me neither.
When everyone finished signing their names and Mr. Yao officially handed my parents the keys, Lupe and I jumped up and down screaming,
We did it! We did it! We did it!
Jason smiled.
You know what I'm going to do? Hank asked, his eyes twinkling.
What?
I asked. Hank ran toward the sparkling blue pool. He let out a yelp as he jumped in fully clothed.
Hey! Mr. Yao called, but only with a fraction of his usual force. You can't jump into my pool with your clothes on. It's not your pool anymore, Hank called back.
Mr. Yao opened his mouth to protest, then closed it. One by one, Lupe and all the Weeklies and essay people and immigrants jumped in too. My dad threw my mom in, and my mom shrieked with glee. Everyone was waiting for me to come in. I turned to Jason. You coming? I asked him. Jason turned to his dad and asked if he could stay. Mr. Yao scoffed.
You don't want to go swimming with these losers, do you? He asked his son.
Jason shook his head.
No, Dad, he said. I'm going swimming with the winners.
Hand in hand, we jumped into the pool. As we splashed and swam in the sun-kissed water, my mother suddenly remembered something very important.
Wait, 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 she said. Let's get a picture.
I'll take it, Hank jumped out.
As he held his hand up and clicked, I looked around at my new family and smiled. It was a picture I'd been waiting a long, long time for. Author's note. Many of the events in Front Desk are based on reality. Growing up, I helped my parents manage several motels in California from when I was 8 years old
to when I was 12 years old. As a kid, I both loved and feared the front desk. I loved the thrill of working, the fact that I could ask an adult for their ID and they'd have to give it to me. I was also petrified at night. I would go to sleep with this choking, painful anxiety, not knowing what might happen in the middle of the night. The part about Mia's mom getting beaten up really happened to my own mother. Would both my parents still be there in the morning when I woke up? At school, I couldn't talk about it with any of my friends. How could I explain to them that my parents came to the United States with only $200 in their pocket? That for the first year, I slept on a mattress we pulled out of the dumpster, hoping my dreams greeted me before the stench did. I also couldn't explain the love and hope that grew out of poverty, how much I bonded with the Weekleys, how we watched out for one another and celebrated the joys together, however small, how my parents hid fellow immigrants from the boss and used a blue baseball cap on the front desk as the secret sign, how a pair of stray cats had kittens on the back stairwell and we hid the kittens in the rooms too, how my dad made soup for the customers when they weren't feeling well, how we became a family. Our new family helped us get through the loneliness and frustration of our situation, the fact that we left behind our friends and family in China, thinking we were going to a better land, only to see our friends and family get rich back home in a way no one could have ever foreseen. There were 536,000 immigrants from mainland China living in the United States in 1990. Unlike the Chinese immigrants who came before them, the post-1965 Chinese immigrants were predominantly skilled. They were highly educated, leaving behind good careers. They took a bet that China was not going to change. They were wrong. Many of them left with very little money because China was still fairly communist in the 80s and early 90s. China has, of course, modernized greatly since then. There is no longer the one-child policy. Now there's the two-child policy. And apartments in Beijing and Shanghai now cost several million U.S. dollars and come with private showers. But in 1990, China's per capita GDP was only U.S. $317. Once in the United States, these immigrants struggled to survive, working long, excruciating hours in manual labor jobs for very little pay. The median annual income in 1989 for Chinese immigrants in the United States was only $8,000, lower than that of any other immigrant group. This unique set of circumstances made these immigrants particularly vulnerable to exploitation and hardship. No group of Chinese immigrants before or since came with quite so little and gave up quite so much. Later, some of these immigrants would go back to China and not recognize the country they left. They would not recognize their brothers and sisters in their designer clothes and handbags. Their brothers and sisters would not recognize them. Neither would the new Chinese immigrants, who would arrive in business class and not understand why anybody would ever turn to the loan sharks. I grew up listening to the stories of these immigrants, stories that brought tears to my eyes and chilled the air in my lungs. I'll never forget when my mom's friend came to stay with us and confessed he worked 18-hour days and slept in his boss's basement because his boss took away his passport and ID. I stayed up all night writing his boss a letter. Though I was just a kid, my letter scared the boss and my mom's friend was freed. I hope in telling these stories, these immigrants' struggles and sacrifices will not be forgotten. They will not be forgotten. And to the nearly 20 million immigrant children currently living in the United States, 30% of whom are living at or below poverty, I hope this book brings some comfort and hope. You are not alone. Somewhere out there, someone in the universe understands exactly what you're going through, including all the fears swirling in your mind or your parents' minds, that you're just a bike. You are not a bike. Finally, I hope that through this book, more people will understand the importance of tolerance and diversity. The owner of one of the motels we managed told us not to rent to African Americans, saying they were dangerous. This infuriated us, and we did not listen. To this day, my family and I are forever grateful to the many, many wonderful people from all different backgrounds who made us feel welcome in our new country and helped us in times of need. Often during tough times, the first instinct is to exclude. But this book is about what happens when you include, when, despite all your suffering and your heartache, you still wake up every morning and look out at the world with fresh, curious eyes.
This is Sunny Liu. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Front Desk by Kelly Yang. This program was directed by Danny Campbell. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by Yang Yang. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.